Now, as the nation gears up for Super Tuesday, the five remaining Republican candidates squared off in the CNN debate last night in Houston.
What started out as a crowded field of contenders has been sifted and winnowed, and last night, the gloves came off.
Joining us now to talk about last night's debate is David Graham. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he live blogged last night's debate in Houston. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So the debates, the Republican debates so far had been lively. I think it's fair to say it seemed like this one was on a whole nother level. Can you talk through just the tone of the debate last night?
Yeah, it was a melee. It was quite a fight, you know, and there was some speculation about what would happen and how Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz would go about dealing with Donald Trump. And the answer was they went hard at him really from the very start. Marco Rubio was throwing punches left and right, and Trump, as is his wont, was firing right back.
Well, here's a taste of just some of the chaos that ensued with this one, Cruz, Trump, and Rubio pretty much all talking at the same time.
Donald claims to care
about him. You know why? I didn't want to, but he sent me his book with his autograph.
Donald, I understand rules
are
very hard for you.
You're doing a great job. I have his book.
Okay,
that's a TV show, not in
public. Thank you for the book.
Donald.
Thank you for the book.
Now, this was not easy listening. There were a lot of portions like this where you could not actually distinguish individual lines of human speech.
That's right. The moderators lost control, and they were just going at it.
So this idea, okay, Rubio attacking Trump, Cruz attacking Trump, a lot of the time there's been this kind of game theory thing where everybody was attacking each other, trying to be the last one standing to run against Trump. They finally changed that and went after Trump directly. The big question people have been asking is this too little too late for them?
I think those are two important and separate questions. The first question is whether or not it works, and I think it's really hard for us to tell at this point what kind of difference it makes. If you're scoring this debate as a technical matter, like, there's no question that Trump did poorly. He didn't have answers to a lot of things. When he was pressed on details, he seemed at sea, and he was really kind of flailing. But generally, I'm not sure that that matters and makes a lot of difference. He's had poor debates before and keeps cruising. If it does work, is it too late? And I think that's a separate and important question. You look at the polling in the states that are coming on Tuesday, and you look at where he is now, and you think, well, even if this did work, why didn't they do it earlier? Maybe they could have avoided the train wreck of Trump, but since they didn't, they may be stuck with him now.
Well, we'll get more into the debate itself in a bit, but some news today. As you said, Trump, some people viewed him as losing this debate. He definitely took a lot of hits. That's what all the talk was about. And then today, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, former candidate, a person who said in the past Trump didn't have the temperament, didn't have the experience to be president. Well, today he's in Texas and he says, I'm endorsing Trump. He's my guy. So does this take away some of the attention from the debate last night?
I think it absolutely does. And it's an incredible moment for a couple of reasons. One is, as you said, the tension between Trump and Christie in the past. And the other is there's been a lot of discussion about when and whether members of the Republican establishment, the old line party, would go about endorsing Trump, and the answer seems to be today. You know, Christie has a lot of enemies in the Republican Party over various things he's done over the years, including attacking Rubio and going back to welcoming Barack Obama to New Jersey back in 2012. So it's not a totally crazy thing. He's also an outspoken guy from the Northeast, but this might be a sign of the floodgate breaking on the establishment. And in any case, it changes the focus away and means that people are now talking about Chris Christie instead of how Trump got pummeled.
Do you think this is maybe in part an endorsement of Trump and in part a New Jersey bird kind of to the Republican establishment? You guys didn't support me. You thought I was too moderate. You made fun of me shaking hands with President Obama. All right, fine. I'm going to endorse the guy you don't want.
I think there's part of that. And I also think there's some specific anti-Rubio sentiment going on. You know, Christie is a guy with a reputation for political retribution and taking things out. There are a lot of accusations, this sort of thing. And he said today, when he was endorsing Trump, he complained specifically about Marco Rubio's super PAC taking shots at him in the New Hampshire primary, which he blamed in part for his loss. So I think he sees it as a way to get back at Rubio, just when Rubio seemed to be maybe gaining some footing.
Well, let's get back to what happened last night in the debate. I want to give a listen to Marco Rubio going after Donald Trump. Here's Rubio challenging Trump over his business record.
You make him
but
in China
and in Russia.
But you
wouldn't know anything about it because you're a lousy businessman.
Well, I don't know anything about bankrupting four companies.
Right. No,
you bankrupted four companies.
You know what?
I don't know anything about starting
that's
a university. That was a fake university.
First of all,
one
at
a fake university.
That's called. Okay,
there are people who borrowed $36,000 to go to Trump University, and they're suing him now.
So attacking Trump, I mean, Trump has said, hey, it's my business resume. That's what qualifies me. And that's attacking his strength. That brings me back to the Bush-Kerry presidential election. Kerry's military experience. Well, then this Swift Boat Group came out and attacked what people perceived as a strength for Kerry. Is this going to be a line of attack for Trump's Republican opponents? You want to run in your business record? We're going to point out the worst things about it.
Absolutely. And it's really surprising to me that it hasn't been more of a line of attack so far. And if it doesn't work for the Republicans and Trump wins the nomination, I guarantee it'll be a line of attack for the Democrats in the general election as well. And his long record, including the bankruptcies, which he insists were strategic, you know, there are many questions of lawsuits and settlements and the Trump University case, in which he's accused of running a big fraud for what are basically real estate seminars. There are really a lot of juicy targets, and it's a surprise that this is the first time we've heard about Trump University in a debate.
Looking at this debate as a whole, there's a good chance that one of those three guys will be the Republican presidential candidate: Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. A lot of people have been saying these guys, the way this went last night, this didn't look very presidential. Is this going to come back to haunt whoever ends up winning this thing?
That's a good question. I mean, I think there are a lot of questions about the tone of this race overall. If it's Trump, you know, his unpresidential tone is maybe his greatest selling point. You know, if it's Rubio or Cruz, maybe, although I think to a certain extent there's a sense that somebody needs to take Trump out because he's such a danger to either the Republican Party or the country. And if it successfully takes him out, I think the people will be grateful enough among the supporters that it won't really hurt either guy. So I would be surprised if it's a major thrust in the general election.
We're looking at last night's GOP debate with David Graham from The Atlantic. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Did you watch this thing? What do you make of it? What do you think of this Chris Christie endorsement of Donald Trump? Call 800-642-1234. Back to the conversation in just a few moments. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking about last night's GOP debate hosted by CNN in Houston, who won, who lost. And what was said is the candidates tried to break away from the pack.
David Graham is our guest. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He live blogged last night's debate. Not a lot. I've seen tracks of time. Donald Trump, lots of time speaking. Kasich, Carson, less. Did either of them really make much of an impression last night, David?
Well, I think Carson may have made an impression he didn't want to make with the line about the fruit salad of life, which he would use as the litmus test for Supreme Court nominees. I'm not sure anyone has any idea what he was talking about there. And beyond that, he sort of was desperate for attention. You know, he begged for someone to attack him so that they would require the moderators to let him speak in response. And he was really a missing presence. Kasich is the other one, and I think this is an important moment for Kasich, who is arguing that he has a claim on this spot to beat Trump. He thinks he can beat Trump in a one-on-one contest if he could knock Rubio and Cruz out. And he was just unable to really get into the debate and get a word in edgewise. When he did, he offered these long, wonky answers, which may impress some voters, but it's hard to break through that trio and assert yourself. So I think this is probably bad news for him.
I mean, if there's a constituency out there that wants maybe more civil reasoned, more presidential behavior, maybe he might shine through. But we've got to see polls yet. It doesn't seem likely that's going to jump him up that much.
Right, exactly. And he's been alternating between a sort of pugnacious approach where he berates the other candidates for being unrealistic and you know, off the deep end, and a sort of kinder, gentler, friendlier approach. And, you know, I think he's gotten a lot farther in the race, well, than, say, Jeb Bush, and farther than a lot of people gave him or would have expected. But getting from there to, you know, really claiming this alternative to Trump lane, I think, is a real challenge.
Let's give a listen again to the debate. Here's Donald Trump coming out in at least partial support of not a popular cause among the Republican Party, Planned Parenthood. Here's a listen.
Millions and millions of women, cervical cancer, breast cancer, are helped by Planned Parenthood. So you can say whatever you want, but they have millions of women going through Planned Parenthood that are helped greatly. And I wouldn't fund it. I would defund it because of the abortion factor, which they say is 3%. I don't know what percentage it is. They say it's 3%, but I would defund it because I'm pro-life. But millions of women are helped by Planned Parenthood.
So that's not something you'll hear from most Republican candidates, something that will confound the party, a lot of the base. What do you make of that, David?
Well, it's a fascinating moment just in the cognitive dissonance there. He's both praising Planned Parenthood and also insisting he would defund it. Sort of on the longer political scale, you see him taking these interesting stands on that. You know, he defends entitlements, he defends Planned Parenthood to a certain extent. When he talks about Obamacare, he insists he would repeal and replace it, but the provisions that he starts talking about sound a lot like what's already in place. And what I think is interesting about Trump is, while he has these really extreme stances on things like refugees and immigration and you know, you name it, he also has some really moderate stances on some things, which maybe traces back to his history as a Democrat. If you look at the exit polls, for example, in South Carolina and New Hampshire, he does really well with moderates. He's taking a lot of that vote that would have gone to people like Jeb Bush or John Kasich, I suspect. And so he's really appealing to people who, they're not, they want small government because they feel there is waste. They feel that there is their handouts being given to people who are not like them, maybe, which might be defined in racial terms. But they're not ideologically obsessed with small government in the same way that a movement conservative might be.
Let's look ahead a little bit. Super Tuesday coming up. A bunch of states at play, including Ted Cruz's home state of Texas. Not long after that, Ohio and Florida, home states of Kasich and Rubio, are coming up. What are you watching for? Does anything that happened in the debate or since affect what's going to happen on Super Tuesday or those states that follow it up?
You know, it'll be interesting to see what the first polls that we get after the debate show and whether there's a lot of movement. But I'm not expecting a great deal of change. And I think on Super Tuesday, one of the important states to watch is obviously going to be Texas. And there's a variety of polls out of Texas. They're kind of all over the place. Some show Trump up and some show Cruz up. If Cruz can't win Texas, it's all over for him. You know, it's his home state. It's a huge pot of delegates. And if he loses there, I think there's not really a rationale for him staying in the race. If he wins, it might be able to tide him over. But I think that's, you know, that's the biggest delegate state, so that's maybe the most interesting place to watch on Tuesday.
Some analysis I've seen, David, is that the Republican Party changed their primary system some to avoid what happened to Mitt Romney with kind of insurgent campaigns running a long time, getting just enough support to stay in there. They wanted to make it easier for a front runner to seal the deal early on. What they didn't know was that front runner was going to be Donald Trump. I mean, they're running out of time, it looks like, for anyone not named Donald Trump to win this thing. Do you think there's a chance of Rubio or Cruz or Kasich actually pulling this out?
Mathematically, there is. Practically, it's getting harder and harder to see. And, you know, we've seen Trump underperform before, as he did in Iowa. But, you know, the polling across the states on Tuesday is strong enough that he's going to have an almost insurmountable delegate lead if he meets expectations on Tuesday. And at that point, I mean, it's possible that the rest of the party could consolidate around either Rubio or Cruz, and they could force, you know, they could deprive Trump of the majority he needs to win the nomination outright, and they could force some sort of floor fight at the convention in Cleveland in July. You know, NBC did some math today, and I haven't checked it myself, and they argued there's no chance for anything except either a Trump nomination or a floor fight.
Wow.
Time is just running out, and they haven't done it.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's David Graham. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Smartphones are everywhere these days. It's normal to see people glued to their phone screens as they walk down the street, even. People are checking their smartphones at the dinner table while they're spending time with friends, even sometimes while they're riding bikes.
We use our phones a lot. You get the idea. But when does it become an addiction? Dr. David Greenfield is with us now to help us figure out when our smartphone use becomes unhealthy and what we can do about it. He's the founder and CEO of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction and an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry. Dr. Greenfield, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So how would you define a smartphone addiction?
Well, if you're using it while you're riding your bicycle, that's probably not a good sign. So, I mean, you know, the word addiction is a medical term that really refers to the most extreme category of use. And really what we're talking about in those cases is that there are four criteria. One is that you're kind of using it like a drug, in other words, to alter mood and consciousness without really awareness. That there's some degree of tolerance, meaning that you're using it more and more, or you're accessing more stimulating information or content. And three, that there's some withdrawal or discomfort when you stop. But four, and the most important, which really puts it into a new category, is the idea that it impacts one of the major life spheres of your life, whether that be homework, schoolwork, occupation, legal status, health, finances, these sort of things. If there's some negative impact, some deleterious impact, then it moves it from sort of use or overuse or even abuse to one where their addiction criteria would be used.
Now, that idea of addiction is probably the most, it sounds like clearly the most extreme cases.
Sure.
Is there a case to be made that you cannot be addicted to your smartphone but still be at an unhealthy level of use?
Yeah, I actually think that's where probably the majority of us are at this point. I mean, with a 90% penetration or pushing 90% penetration in the U.S., I think many of us are overusing it. If you go into any local place where people are waiting, I would dare say you'd find a situation where most people in the room are not holding one or staring into one. You know, the question is, what is the negative consequence of that? And there's all sorts of theories about it at this point. But I think it's pretty well accepted at this point that most of us are overusing it or abusing it.
Is there a way to easily keep tabs on how much we're using it? Because sometimes we're not the best judge. We might think, oh, I can stop anytime I want. I can cut back anytime I want. So how do we really know how much we're using it?
You know, I mean, everybody says that about things that they're using habitually. The question is, do you? So it's not so much whether you can. The question is, do you? So you have to back up the statement that you can with doing something differently. And that's where we see a lot of people having trouble. You know, when I suggest people to not take it in to dinner with them or to turn it off before they have a meal or before they do certain things, people actually have a hard time doing it because they're very unconscious about their use. Most of us are not aware because we dissociate when we use it. We're not conscious of the amount of time and energy that it takes. And we found that from our research back in the late 90s with the Internet. And the smartphone is really just a portableized Internet platform.
Now, say someone's out there listening and thinking, okay, I'm not in that addiction category, but maybe, yeah, I do use my phone too much. What do you recommend? What do you recommend as a step to wean ourselves off to a more healthy level?
Yeah, there's a few steps that we recommend. One is we recommend that you don't use it as an alarm clock. You know, get the thing out of your bedroom, buy an alarm clock for $10, and use an alarm clock so you don't have to have it right next to your bed. You know, we did a survey with AT&T, and we found 60% of people sleep with it under their pillow or next to their bed. The other thing is turn off some of the notifications so it's not always beeping, buzzing, and blipping and letting you know that things are coming in that you feel you need to react to or respond to. The third thing is don't have a meal with your phone next to you. Turn it off, put it away. There should not be a plate and a fork and a spoon and then a smartphone on the table when you eat. Consider having a period of time that's a natural break. The other thing is never, 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 under any circumstance, use the phone while you're driving. It's extremely dangerous, 5 to 6 times greater likelihood of having an accident. And in some studies, there is evidence to show that more people are dying from distracted driving by using smartphones than they are from alcohol-related deaths. So there are significant issues with using the smartphone while driving. So those are some tips. The idea is to bring consciousness or mindfulness to your use so you're not doing it automatically. Next time you go into a waiting room for a doctor's appointment, don't bring your phone in with you. Just sit there. Be patient. A lot of people have a hard time allowing themselves to be quiet and still and what we would call boredom. But sometimes out of those moments of quietness or stillness or boredom comes creativity or refreshment or relaxation, which we don't allow ourselves to ever get into because we're always entertaining or connecting.
I think there's kind of a disincentive to do what you're talking about because chances are nobody else around you is doing it. I mean, it seems like whenever I try or I forget my phone or if I do intentionally leave it somewhere so I won't have it, everybody else that I'm with does have it. And so I just sort of sit there, you know, and everyone else is on.
Yeah,
the
you know, it's funny you say because I just had that experience. I was in a doctor's waiting room yesterday and I was sitting there and I was the only one that didn't have one. And I'm sitting there saying, yeah, this feels really odd. But it also sort of felt good that I was able to just sit and be still for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and relax because that we used to have that time built in. We no longer have that because we now have a portal that connects us to everything in the world and that we feel compelled to broadcast everything we do. Otherwise, it doesn't exist, or we didn't do it, or we feel like we're letting someone else down, or we're not staying in touch. But that creates a tech stress response and elevates cortisol levels, which is antithetical to being relaxed. So I don't know that ultimately, when we survey people, ultimately when people stop using it, they really say that they're not missing anything. It's just this fear of missing out that people talk about that is really artificial.
Talking to David Greenfield from the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. Let's talk about concentration and what those constant beeps and pings and notifications from the cell phone does to us while we're trying to do something else, do some work, read a book, cook a meal.
Well, it does two things. One is there's no such thing as multitasking. I think everybody knows that. There's ample research to show that. So if you're trying to do one thing, a task, whatever it is, and you're being notified by your phone, your attention is going to be pulled to that phone. But the other more important part of that is that notification elevates a release of dopamine in anticipation of the possibility of something being there that you might find pleasurable. We have ample research to show that digital technology elevates dopamine, and it's the expectation that there might be a reward there, similar to a slot machine, that elevates that dopamine. And that puts you into a aroused state, and it is a neurotransmitter that is associated with pleasure in the same area of the brain that's affected by sexuality or eating or other pleasurable behaviors in the nucleus accumbens in the limbic system. So those notifications really light you up. And not in huge ways, but in small ways. But if you have them happening all day long, there's no time that you're not being affected by those responses.
I can remember about 5 years ago, it seems like there were all these books out saying our attention spans are getting smaller and shorter. We have the attention span of a gnat now because we're all on our phones. Is that what the research now has found? Are we kind of making ourselves having...
Well, I've not read any studies that have compared us to a gnat yet.
Not technically.
I mean, I've been accused of that. I mean, yeah, there is some data that shows that our attention spans are shortening, but we're not talking about by huge percentages. There's some small percentage differences. I think what it is that we're overstimulated, and so we're used to having multiple channels of input, but you really can't attend to multiple channels. What you do is you switch back and forth, which takes comprehension longer because you're always having to switch channels. For instance, when I come into work, I have to check 6 channels of communication, whether it be texting, email, voicemail, all the different things, and that takes a huge amount of time. There's no way to do that in a short way, and you can't do it all at once.
As we wrap up, this is still a fairly new technology. Do you think things are just going to keep getting worse and worse, or are we starting to hit a point where we're realizing, okay, we got to set some ground rules here, or this is just going to ruin our lives?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, we get smarter and smarter. I mean, this isn't the first example of how technology can impact our lives. And I think we're beginning, there's a bit of a backlash in terms of establishing what I call an electronic etiquette. The idea of sort of how, when, and where to use the technology and in what ways we can use it in the healthier way, in healthier ways and in more appropriate ways socially. I think that that's emerging. And I think people are also sort of getting the idea that, yeah, this stuff's great, but there's more to life than these technologies.
Dr. Greenfield, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. David Greenfield, founder and CEO of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction and an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry. He joined us there to talk about smartphone addiction.